Jimi Hendrix, and of course a notable feature of his musicianship was... Stop doing an imaginary drum beat.
I'm sorry, yes. It was a very sinister choice of music.
Okay, you've answered it. Left-handed. And in Britain, a former Conservative Defence Minister wants every teacher to be trained to recognise the needs of left-handed children, and this got us interested. The Tory MP Peter Lough says teacher training and the national curriculum there should be overhauled so that children are given the space and the correct implements to achieve the same results as right-handed pupils, because the current lack of understanding of left-handed people is leaving the self-esteem and self-worth of children, left-handed children, at risk as they struggle with right-handed scissors or with having cramped illegible handwriting, and teachers are unaware of their differing needs. Now, you're a teacher.
And every year we get given lists of our students' ethnicity, of their scores, of their, we are never informed of their chirality, and this is not an issue that ever has been presented to us as being an impediment to their learning.
Well, after having...
Is that a bit gauche of me?
No. But after having observed a number of young people over a number of years and becoming aware gradually, I suppose, of some of the left-handedness of some of them, have they been inconvenienced, thwarted? Has their self-esteem been damaged, etc.?
Well, I mean, at least we don't beat it out of them any longer.
No, well, that's
something. We're not the nuns with the canes telling them it's a sign of the devil. You know, and maybe it is, I don't know. But no, I mean, how are they actually meaningfully inconvenienced, really?
It's a right-handed world.
We use scissors at my school, for example, and as far as I can tell, they're symmetrical.
I'm 6'5",
yes.
And I have been tall my whole life, funnily enough, and so that means that while I was the same age as a lot of my contemporaries, I was much taller than them, cramped into the little chairs mm-hmm. that everybody else had to sit in. And the reality is that apart from the fact that I'm a hunchback and got slightly, you know, funny feet, I've survived. I think you can't, we can't get to the bottom of absolutely everybody's...
But, Michael, are you left or right-handed?
Well, I'm right-handed.
Well, there you go, then. You see, there's no problem.
Which means I'm unlikely to be an American president quickly, according to the information we were given. Or a catwalk model, which I found most distressing,
yes,
given that was what I was going to do next.
Imagine if you'd been tall and left-handed.
Absolutely.
And,
having read this, I thought, bugger, what a shame. I wished I'd been a left-handed person.
Because we went online today and we found in some seemingly reputable publications the advantages of left-handedness.
Mm.
And I don't know if we sent all of them to you, but mm-hmm. left-handed people apparently spend less time queuing because people veer towards their dominant side and right-handers go right and the left-handers go to the queues with fewer people in them on the left. They're better at learning to drive in countries like ours, according to, for example, the AA driving school in Britain, 10% more likely to pass their driving test. As Michael says, they make natural catwalk models. I couldn't really work that out.
No.
But anyway, it's claimed. It's an advantage in many sports. Left-handed men may make more money, claims the website anythinglefthanded.com, which may have a slight bias. But
yes,
they're purported to earn 13% more than their right-handed counterparts. And to cut a long story short, left-handedness seems to be advantageous in a number of areas of life.
My wife's left-handed, and it bothers me to watch her write with a left hand. It just seems wrong. But then when she's on the computer, and she does that, you know, she makes her living sitting at the computer, she mouses with her right hand. And it just confuses me.
Left-handed stroke victims, it's claimed, recover faster than right-handed stroke victims. I'd like to see the research on it. But anyway, all right, so you don't think left-handed people need special treatment?
By the sounds of it, most of us need to be trained to write with our left hand.
Yeah, it sounds like they've got enough breaks already.
Yeah, they seem significantly advantaged. If the worst that happens is you can't use some scissors, well, you know, life can get tougher than that, actually.
Listeners are telling you that scissors are never symmetrical, and Jenny of Tutahi Bay says left-handed scissors are a gift of the gods, actually, for a left-handed person.
Well, yeah. I'm sure they are, but I'm not sure that we need to change our... I think that Peter Lough was suggesting the entire curriculum needs to be overhauled. Teacher training.
Yeah. I shall recommend it as soon as I get back to school tomorrow. The alternative always is train everyone to be ambidextrous. Mm. I mean, I'd give my right arm to be ambidextrous, personally.
You're saving up that one.
I'm sorry. I'll stop now.
That's quite all right. No, don't stop, actually. Steve McCabe is on the panel with Michael Moynihan. Steve, what's on your mind?
Well, so speaking of teaching and such like, I've been listening lately to our wonderful education minister, Hekia Parata, and her ongoing will we, won't we discussion on whether or not she's going to try and introduce performance pay, whether it's for teachers or for schools. And she apparently has been saying that she wants to get performance pay for teachers introduced, at which point we're saying, OK, let's introduce performance pay for ministers and put her on performance pay, in which case she'd probably owe money back to the Crown, quite frankly. But we're not certain if it's going to be introduced or not. Then there's talk of performance pay for schools. Are we going to start to do, instead of decile funding, are we going to start to have performance-based funding for schools to try and increase student achievement? And while, first of all, obviously performance pay in something as vague a science as education is almost impossible to implement effectively, because what exactly is performance? It's so very, very difficult to actually manage. But the real issue that's at the heart of all this is student achievement. And everything that we're ever being told is that whatever is being done is to drive student achievement. And we're being talked about how we can incentivize schools to improve student achievement, how we can incentivize teachers to improve student achievement. The only thing that will ever meaningfully change student achievement, in the opinion of myself and I think just about any teacher I've spoken to, is something that teachers and schools have absolutely no control over whatsoever, and that's what goes on inside the home. If a child comes from a home where education is talked up, is valued, is respected, is given value and merit, then that child will come to school with an attitude that says, you know, there's a point to being here. If a child comes from a school where education and school are not reinforced, explicitly or implicitly, then that child will not come to school with a positive attitude toward their education. That child will not achieve in the same way as a child that's supported by the parents. And unfortunately, that is something that as teachers we have no control over. We will do everything we can to invite parents in. We will phone home when we can, but we'll... if we're not getting parental buy-in, we are not going to be able to do anything. And trying to either incentivize or penalize teachers or schools for something that we ultimately have limited control over, I'm going to say I just don't like.
Okay, you're saying that's a sine qua non, but in fact, teachers surely can, even with children from disadvantaged homes or in homes with completely indifferent parents and very little support, can still have their outcomes immeasurably improved by good teachers.
We can certainly make a difference, as people like to say, but there is a limit to the difference we can make. We are one factor. The quality of the facilities within which we teach, the quality of the school management and structures are, again, a factor, but they are all dwarfed by the big influence, which is parental involvement, and that's going to limit the extent to which we can influence student achievement.
All right. A number of left-handed listeners, in fact, quite a considerable number, are saying we've talked about the topic glibly and they could use more support in life. So there we go. I might address some of that tomorrow. Thank you, Steve McCabe. Michael Moynihan, what's on your mind, please?
Well, I've been very concerned about the rights of left-handed people. And I feel that... No, I'm joking there. Sorry, that was me.
This is the very fact we talk about rights means that we were immediately inherently prejudiced against lefties.
I do. I was being glib and I shouldn't have been. I've been concerned, I guess, in the last few days and increasingly by what I perceive as the difficulty of maintaining a sense of being informed, particularly about significant and unfolding issues, and to a large extent, I'll use the story around the disappearing aeroplane as an example. But what I've been overwhelmed, I have to say, by what I see as a very confused conversation going on, particularly in the media, about what's happening. And the fact is that I think it's a confusing issue anyway. There's a lot of conflicting information and a lot of varying stories. But what I'm missing as just an ordinary consumer of information is some kind of calm and measured and curated place that I can go and try and come to either my own conclusion or an informed conclusion because I've been supported by somebody who's done some research and somebody who has provided a relatively clutter-free environment in which to make that those thoughts. It seems that there is this issue and others. I think it's true about the issues in the Ukraine. In a kind of global instant media environment, we're getting much less curated information and much more, here's another expert, here's another expert, here's another theory, here's another theory, here's another agency, here's another. And I'm finding it a bit of a struggle to actually manage any kind of sense of being adequately informed.
Michael, there is a place you can go to find that kind of curated information. It's called 1986. Unfortunately, that no longer exists because of the technology that's been introduced since then. You can't get that anymore. Through the 90s, we started getting like the 24-hour rolling news stations where they just have to fill the time with talking heads. Since then, we've now got the internet and Twitter, God forbid, is the worst for it. People have it offered to them. People crave it. They just want more and more. And it seems like the filters, as you said, the curation is no longer happening. That ship has sailed.
It's not just media shrillness, though, because a lot, I think you've just alluded to this. The media, I think, a lot of them have tried to be responsible, have wheeled out experts, was the word you used. The trouble is with the missing Malaysian Airlines plane, the experts all have wildly differing opinions.
Well, there are no experts in that case, are there?
Steve, I don't think that's particularly... I don't think it's fair to say that there shouldn't be a place where, in actual fact, there is a degree of analysis beyond just simply... Some of the reportage that I've seen is just simply links to other stuff. There isn't any filter at all going on. And I'm not sure that that is necessary, and I'm not sure that in an environment where the media is increasingly finding it complicated to prove its value, that actually, if in fact the best way of proving value is not to actually provide a bit more curation around it. And I'm not making a criticism of the fact that this is I'm not suggesting this is an easy issue to deal with. What I'm suggesting is that actually just reporting on reporting gets more and more complicated.
But it seems these days like the focus for a number of outlets is on quantity of reporting rather than quality.
Curation sounds like a quiet museum. That's the trouble, isn't it, really?
Well, no, I think curation is,
what you mean.
You can call it a filter. You can call it a perspective. And I actually am not sure that quiet isn't a bad idea with some of these issues, because there seems to be a lot of noise.
I'll tell you what, the noise isn't stopping. I've had listeners emailing me today with, eyewitness reports from the Andaman Islands and the Maldives, and, of course, the newest complete electrical failure theory, and it goes on and on and on. That's partly in the absence of information.
And I get that. But I think it's actually true of a number of other things as well. I think this is absolutely true in this instance, but I do think that there are other... it's a symptom that... And I'm not a curmudgeonly old stick-in-the-mud either, particularly. I mean this almost as a way of encouraging media to think there is an option around valued filter.
All right. Michael Moynihan, Steve McCabe on the panel. New Zealand's economic ties with China have been strengthened with a deal to allow direct trading of the New Zealand dollar against the Chinese renminbi or yuan. And the deal struck relatively swiftly after negotiations began in April last year will reduce costs for exporters and importers by removing the necessity for transactions to be settled in two foreign exchange trades via a third currency, usually the US dollar. So our Prime Minister and Chinese Premier announced the agreement after meeting at the Great Hall of the People during Mr. Key's first day of an official visit to China. That may not impact either of your lives significantly, but before we talk to Senior Economist at Westpac, Michael Gordon, about this and one other matter, you'd welcome this? You think it's a good step forward or not?
As a bit of a tangent, it did entertain me a little bit that John Key is taking money out of currency traders' pockets.
There's okay. An irony there, you think.
A little bit.
Tongue-in-cheek. Michael?
No, look, I think that there is always a value in making things as simple as possible. And this is symbolic, as I understand it, as much as it is anything. It talks about the relationship between the two countries, which there has to be, again, a value in that. It does seem to me interesting, and I don't want to read more into it than I should, but does this mean that eventually the kind of U.S. dollar currency standard thing is getting eroded, and perhaps it's not as, this is the beginning of the fact that there could be other options than just simply measuring it up against the U.S. dollar.
All right, let's ask Michael Gordon that first, who's kindly joining us, senior economist at Westpac. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, does this presage the diminishing usefulness of the United States dollar in any shape or form?
We're probably only talking over a very long period of time for that. The Chinese authorities have been going through a very gradual process of freeing up their financial markets. So, for instance, you've been able to buy yuan with US dollars for quite some time, and now they're opening it up to a few more currencies, and New Zealand is the sixth one to be included in that group. But they're really doing this as a very long-term step towards eventually moving towards a fully floating, or I guess fully tradable, Chinese yuan. But, it's a plan that they're sort of talking about in, 10, 15-year horizons, maybe more. So it's probably some time before you have to worry about, the Chinese yuan sort of being a kind of a dominant currency in the world stage. And I guess it's not even obvious that you really need to have one dominant currency, like the role that the US dollar plays right now, or the British pound has played in times past anyway.
We also heard today, Michael, that the value of dairy product exports has grown again, thanks to China. But a question about the Chinese economy, because that middle class we have always been led to understand, that burgeoning middle class, has grown almost entirely, it seems, on a real estate boom. And I noticed the Wall Street Journal today, and of course they've talked about the Chinese economy collapsing for the last goodness knows how many years, and we say not that again, but I noticed the Wall Street Journal today and other media are seeing very serious signs, especially with this defaulting of the Zhejiang Jingrun real estate firm owing $400 million worth of bank loans. They're seeing things, to put it simply, tottering in China. What are economists seeing, please, Michael, at the moment?
I think you have to bear in mind, we've had a fairly recent change in the philosophy of the leadership. We had, in China, we sort of had the change in leadership was back in 2010, but it was only last year where they had what's called the third plenum, which is traditionally where they've kind of announced their grand vision and sort of really kind of signaled dramatic changes. And one of the things they talked about in this plenum late last year was giving markets a prominent role in the economy. And that's something that they're talking about, again, over, this is the plan for the next 10 years or so. Part of that is going to mean applying market discipline, so failed businesses should be allowed to fail. And because of that hasn't been the approach for a long time in the past, it's going to be quite painful to wean people off this idea that the government's going to step in and rescue people, whenever there's business collapses or whenever the economy starts to slow. So it's going to be a very difficult balancing act for them, I think. They're going to have to, on the one hand, let some businesses fail kind of as an example, but at the same time, they don't want it to get to the point where it's, causing systemic problems for them. So, as I said, it's going to be a real tricky balancing act. But, I think they've shown a fair ability to kind of manage these kind of odd balances, over recent years.
All right, so you're not reading a crash into it yet. But, I mean, property for China is almost, in terms of GDP, like dairy is for us, isn't it? It accounts for a huge percentage of that economy over there.
It has been a huge part, and some of it is going to be justified given the urbanisation trends, but I think there's inevitably a sort of a bubble element in there as well. And at times you have seen the authorities clamp down on the on property development. In fact, they introduced some new restrictions again late last year, and I think was sort of seeing that come through a bit. The property development sector itself is probably actually in reasonably good health. They've kind of cleared a lot of the stock of unsold homes that they had late last year. So there are going to be some marginal players that will get in the headlines, but generally they're probably better positioned now than they have been in the last few years.
All right. Thank you. Michael Gordon from Westpac. grateful for his appearance on the panel. Just quickly.
I was going to say, isn't the underlying issue here the fact that the question of New Zealand's significant dependence on milk and on selling milk to China, this regardless of whether there is a crash coming, and I'm sure that what Michael says is correct, the bigger issue is, can we transition our economy a little to be less reliant on milk and on China, and actually use this as a moment to say, well, let's just think a little broader than we have been necessarily.
All right, thank you. Now, Barry Allen is going to join us on these two last topics, which will fit in. An Auckland man's won a battle against a towing company after his van was illegally towed from a private car park in central Auckland. He didn't have permission to park there, but the Automobilers Association is saying that Stephen Oy's win at the Disputes Tribunal is a victory for motorists and could set a precedent, because Super City Towing was found to have breached regulations by not completing a tow authority, a form that towing companies are required to complete and have signed by a police officer, a traffic warden or a landlord before removing the vehicle. And he had caused no actual harm, said the tribunal, by parking at the Wellesley Street car park without permission because the building was empty and it was outside usual business hours. And this is interesting because it raises the issue of harm. Where is the harm in parking in a business car park late at night? Do you see any harm in it?
Well, technically no, and it is a little bit mean-spirited for the owner of the car park to say, well, it's my car park, you can't have it, I'm not using it, but you can't either. It's a little bit petty, but at the same time the concern then would be, okay, fine, I'll say, put a sign up saying available for use between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m.
Yeah, but yeah.
And then what happens if you show up in the morning and someone's parked the car and haven't removed it?
But the owner of the car park has, because it'll be a private car park within a public building. The owner who has the contract with the public building has bought that space, and they bought that space for 24 hours a day. So it's not mean spirited at all. It's their car park; they can use it whenever they want.
And that's the contrary argument. Barry Allen teaches the law of contracts and torts at Otago University Law School. Hello, Barry.
How are you?
Very kind of you to join us. It's not a precedent at law, is it?
Well, it's only a disputes tribunal, which is a bit unfortunate.
But it's a useful decision, though.
I think so. It sends some message. And I think, that procedural thing about not filling in the paperwork is probably the less important one, because they can fix that. But if the concern is really with this question of harm, and the tribunal is starting to say, oh, there's no harm, so therefore these things shouldn't happen, if that sort of idea becomes prevalent, then that's going to be great assistance to motorists.
Yeah, okay. Couldn't you get a sheaf of forms signed by the landlord in advance and just hand them out on the night? I mean, it wouldn't
They could possibly just have a sort of one universal contract they sign in advance, just giving a universal permission to come and do this or request.
Sorry, in the context of contract law, do you have the capacity to ignore a contract on the basis that the contravention of that contract is not causing harm?
But there's no contract between someone who's parking, overparking. We're in the law of tort now.
No, but there's a contract between the person who has rented the car park from the car park owner.
Yes.
And that contract says, I will make this car park available to you for 24 hours a day, and in return you pay me a certain amount for it.
That's right.
That is a contract. You can't overrule that contract by saying somebody who subsequently parks in it hasn't done any harm.
Well, it's not really overruling the contract, and there would be harm, for example, if, as a result of these wrongly parking people, the people who have the contractual rights can't park there.
Right, so does it depend on whether it's an individually allocated car park or just a big corporate car park?
I think establishing harm would be a lot easier if it is an individual car park.
All right, good. Okay. So it's watch the space with that one, basically.
I think so.
Okay. One more thing, Barry. We learned today that City New World New Plymouth's customers are eating their bluff oysters before they get to the checkout.
I can understand that, but carry on.
And empty oyster pottles being left around the store.
Yes.
Now, is this theft? You can't do this no matter whether you've run out the door with a trolley full of groceries or...
Well, this is a particular scenario where they're actually leaving the pottles on the shelves. Obviously not having any kind of intention to take them up and pay for them.
Right.
So there's where your theft is. If they put the pottle into their trolley and then took it through and said, oh, well, I ate my oysters on the way through, then, because it all comes down to a question of intention, do they eat these with the intention of paying or not?
Yep.
And so if they're honest in their purpose, then that would be okay. Very hard to establish who's honest and who's not, though, until the actual checkout.
So you can eat as many oysters in the store as you like as long as you're honest at checkout?
Well, that's the law. It doesn't, yeah, generally speaking, because you require an intent to steal from the supermarket.
Right.
And if you're planning to pay, of course, you have to be believed that you plan to pay, of course.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. All right. Thank you very much for that, Barry. Barry Allen.
No worries.
Half-eaten chocolate Easter bunnies in Pukekohe Countdown just recently. Quite sad.
Yeah. That's a different topic entirely. Steve McCabe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Moynihan, you too. Grateful to have the company of both of you. Checkpoint follows. Thanks, everybody. We're back tomorrow.